Welcome to The Authority File, the academic library podcast from Choice. Choice is a publishing division of the ACRL and the publisher of Choice Reviews and CC Advisor. This episode is brought to you by Human Relations Area Files, or HRAF. I'm Bill Mickey, the host of the podcast and the editorial director at Choice, and for this four-episode series, my guests and I discuss the origin of the Human Relations Area Files as an independent cross-cultural research agency based at Yale and as a publisher of the uniquely developed eHRAF World Cultures and Archaeology databases. We'll also describe some of the new research our guests are currently developing in their respective fields. So, as in our previous episodes, I'm joined by Dr. Carol Ember, president of HRAF and lead investigator on a five-year NSF-supported interdisciplinary research project to study how natural hazards may have transformed cultures. Also joining us is Dr. Peter Peregrin, HRAF's chairman of the board and Lawrence University professor of anthropology. In this final episode of our four-part series, we'll discuss the research that our guests have been conducting to investigate the transformative effects natural hazards and disasters have on cultures and how this research could inform public policy. Okay, so let's talk about some of the grant research you've both been doing. You've been working under a five-year NSF grant to examine how natural disasters have changed cultures and caused them to adapt in various ways. And Carol, why don't we start with you, if you could tell us a little bit about the direction your research is taking and what you found so far.
Sure. So obviously we're facing accelerated climate change. And this is one of the main reasons we wanted to undertake this grant. Basically, we want to understand how societies in the past coped with natural hazards and other resource stressors to see possibly what cultural features might have been adaptive and allowed people to deal with those environments. Now, climate change is accelerating, but hazards, are not new. And they have occurred in the past. So our strategy in this project is to compare samples of societies to see if people in more hazard-prone environments had different cultural features than those in less hazard-prone environments. We're still analyzing our data, but one of the most important findings we have found is that people in more resource-stressed environments have much more customary beyond household sharing, both sharing food and sharing labor, not just during a disaster, but as regular practice. There are even some societies where people share food every day. They make more dinner than they can eat, and they take to all their neighboring households. And they do that just as part of their custom. So the theory behind this, our expectation, which was supported, is that sharing minimizes the vulnerability of individual households and is itself an adaptive, sharing is an adaptive cultural practice. Now, some people, of course, might have spun an alternative idea that in face of hard times, people would pull back. But our data actually suggests that in the course of the actual disaster, there's actually more sharing going on. Then one of our co-investigators, Michelle Bilfand, previously had found that more interest in rules and punishment of deviant people in countries that had more disasters. This was a country-level study. We decided to take a look at the ethnographic record. If we generalize this to resource stress and other stressors generally, not just to natural hazards, we have found research which supports what she found in countries. Societies with more stressors have stronger rules. They seem to care about rules more, including in the ethnographic record, how rules about how people marry, how you bring up children, how they bury their dead. We've even found in societies with more stress, having strong rules about how you're supposed to eat meals. Societies that have more stress tend to have more orchestration and more rules of etiquette around meal eating. And they actually also have, interestingly, more standard clothing and more standard adornment. So that it seems to be there's a certain way you're supposed to dress, and most people dress that way. So you going to ask a question?
Yeah, no, I was just curious to see if like there was any kind of causation there that you were able to uncover in terms of, you know, the why those stresses may be influencing those particular customs.
Well, here Michelle and I probably have some disagreement, but her original theory was that in the face of stress, it's very important for people to cooperate. And her theory is that the stress if cooperation is required, it's important for people to reinforce their behaviors in some more rule-driven way. I'm somewhat skeptical because I'm not sure that in the face of stress that it's so adaptive to be that tight. I think there are points at which more flexibility may be important to be able to try new things. So where we actually have in mind, but we haven't gotten yet to this point, to see if there's some, I expect actually some curvilinearity, that in the face of stress, there's tightening of social norms and rules, but with more stress, I think more flexibility will be found. But as I said, this is still ongoing, and so we'll see, but the interesting part to me is that the ethnographic data so far does correspond with the cross-country data.
Okay. And then, Peter, how about you?
I've been involved in the same project using archaeological information. And, in fact, I've been able to do a lot of analysis because I had far fewer cases that I needed to code. And the main finding that I've come out with is that societies that provide more opportunities for people to participate in political decision making tend to have less change following what I'm calling catastrophic natural disasters. In the archaeological record, very simple natural disasters, a flood, a period of drought are very difficult to see, but catastrophic ones that affect an entire society, maybe like the hurricane that hit Puerto Rico and wiped everything out, those kinds of disasters you can see archaeologically. And what I found is that in the face of those kinds of disasters, the societies that provide more opportunities for political participation tend to do better than those that don't.
So that actually would support the flexibility idea, wouldn't it?
Yes, and that's that I disagree with Michelle on some things with that also. But that's how we do research. There's four of us working together, and we're trying to understand this, and we disagree, and then we come to agreements, and we disagree again, and that's. That's how progress is made.
So, Peter, is there an assumption there, perhaps, that at least politically, these societies can kind of rebound a little bit more quickly and get those institutions back in place following
The underlying theory that I'm working with comes out of modern theory in disaster prevention and management.
Okay.
And following Hurricane Katrina, the whole concept of how disasters are handled changed because of the failures that were there. And in those, maybe 15 years, there's been real changes. And so one of the key things that disaster managers are looking at now is participation and decision making at a local level mm-hmm. is really important. There's a concept called social capital, which is related to what Carol was talking about with sharing, that at a local level, if a community has strong ties and people support one another, those ties and that support can be called on in a disaster and helps people to get through that disaster. At the political level, it seems very important that communication is open and free on a similar level, so that at the community level, various people in the community, the fire department, police department, citizens, the electric company, are all able to communicate and coordinate together, which is different than what was called the command and control model that was in place before Hurricane Katrina, which would be a response agency would communicate to a control point, and then that control point would communicate back down to another response agency, instead of those two response agencies just directly communicating with one another. And that seems to me clear in the archaeological study that I've done, that that's the societies that provide that kind of interaction that aren't controlled by a very tight hierarchy are able to do better in the face of catastrophic disasters.
I just realized that Peter mentioned that his disasters in the archaeological record are catastrophic, as opposed to the ethnographic record. They tend to be, in the ethnographic record, they're not tending to be catastrophic. And so, Peter, your data might actually support this curvilinear idea that when it's really severe, it's more adaptive to be more flexible, which would probably go in a more participatory system. But in a milder stress situation, it's possible, Michelle is right, that that a little bit more tightness leads to a little bit more cooperative behavior. There's one other theory that I should mention, which is a more psychological theory, and that is that disasters simply increase people's fear, and fear very often leads to wanting more certainty in some realm of your life. Michelle herself has actually pointed out that after 9/11, people in the United States seem to get a lot more interested in punishment of different kinds of people and tightening up our rules regarding certainly who can come here. And so it almost seemed like the initial reaction was tightening, not necessarily in an adaptive way, but it could be a psychological response to fear.
And Carol, see, so this is a live demonstration of research activity in process. I actually do have those curvilinear relationships, but I don't have the statistical power to be able to say that I have them. So, or at least not in print, but they're very much there. Yeah.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Yeah. I need more cases. We need more money.
Yeah, no, I think what we were just discussing does sort of bring up this idea of sort of informing public policy, and I'm wondering, Peter, if you know, and Carol, you know, what you're researching might be able to help predict certain outcomes today, and how that might be used to inform appropriate policy responses. I'm wondering if, sort of hypothetically, if you could sit down with policymakers, what you might tell them about the conclusions from your studies, and you know, what policies might be implemented in light of those.
Well, yeah, and I have spent some time thinking about that, and have actually published some ideas along those lines. It's not feasible, I think, to sit down and tell our senators and congressmen to create a more politically participative society. That's not going to work. Right. But I find it interesting that many people don't know that in their county there is an emergency manager, there's an emergency management agency, there's an emergency management plan. It would be very helpful if those agencies and citizens were able to interact more so that they knew who one another was, how to communicate with one another, that the plan exists, and to help participate in creating emergency management plans. At that level, political participation, I think my research would suggest, could be very effective in aiding future disasters. And that's the sort of thing that local county councils and town councils could very easily encourage and spend a little money to promote. At state levels, I think the same thing is true. You could have ongoing dialogues between representatives and emergency managers and citizens that could, I think, prove very beneficial, just so everyone knows how a response would take place. The other thing is, social capital seems so important in these responses, and it seems to me that that's an area where we are not doing so well anymore. I think churches used to form a backbone for interaction, mutual support, and church membership is way down. But again, local governments could aid in creating those bonds by supporting community centers, supporting community gatherings. Here in Appleton, if you want to have one, you can have a block party. I think that's a great idea. Those kind of things are what it would seem are the types of things that help people survive disasters. So there are policy things that can be done. And it's just getting the word out.
Yeah, exactly. And then, Kara, I'm wondering if you came to any similar, you know, ideas or conclusions on your side of the research there.
Well, I actually haven't thought about this as much as I probably should. But the problem for me is some of the implications of our research. There are some obvious things to change, but how to get them to be changed is pretty difficult, such as we know from our cross-cultural research that war predicts a lot of kinds of violence of other kinds. Cross-nationally, war predicts more homicide. This has been found in simpler cultures as well. War predicts training boys to be aggressive, presumably in the future to be warriors, but aggression spins off in a lot of harmful ways. So the kind of conclusion from some of that research suggests that we want to have a world full of less violence, we have to minimize war. My problem is that seems pretty obvious, but there's a long stretch from if we know that that's true, how do you bring that about? It's a pretty formidable problem to bring about culture change at that level. But now that Peter is talking, I began to think about something that Peter, from what Peter just said. One, in terms of problems with natural hazards, and by the way, I want to back up a second. We know from our early research from this project that natural hazards is actually a major predictor of more war. So minimizing the effects of natural hazards by making sure that people have disaster relief so they don't have to try to grab resources from other people is an obvious policy implication. But I realized from what Peter is saying that you need policy implications on a lower level. Otherwise, it's probably not going to work. And one of the things I think policymakers need to be more aware of is what are some of these local responses to natural hazards? I mean, if you just look in the ethnographic record, about people who live in floodplains or near bodies of water that regularly flood, you find, for example, very simply that they don't build houses in the way we build them. One, if they can, they don't build them right next to the water. Two, they build buildings in different ways, so that actually some of which they're doing now, like building buildings up a story with on piles. So there's lots of strategies people have come up with, including sharing. And that brings me to maybe something that's a little bit more plausible, which is, as Peter was talking, I realized that it's extremely important to build more sense of community. And that would be an implication from my research as well. Remember, going back to research on political participation, that has an impact on minimizing violence, probably within the community as well as between communities. But developing community resources and understanding how communities around the world cope with a variety of issues would be pretty important for policy. As I say, the biggest thing is changing the big thing. Not so easy to figure out how to do.
I'd like to just point out that from this discussion, I hope that you can see the ethnographic record is not just some kind of esoteric set of information, but is really a catalog of all sorts of different experiments that humans have done in ways of living and ways of organizing themselves. And some have been successful and some have not been. And so by studying the ethnographic and archaeological record, we can find those conditions that seem to work best for humans in particular contexts and those that don't seem to work very well. The ethnographic and archaeological records are really valuable resources for us, and it's that Hraf provides in a very usable format for scholars to employ.
And this brings you back to our earlier remark that the earlier stuff is very useful. Because if you just look at what people are doing when they're, quote, modernizing, in a lot of societies, they're building houses like we build houses. They're building them with roofs that get too hot instead of thatched roofs. They're building them in places that people previously didn't build their houses because they were too close to rivers. So if you just look at the so-called modernized world or the globalized world, you're not going to get that variety of experiments and not going to be able to learn from them.
And you're going to, perhaps, if we're looking at more modern things, only be looking at the winners. And it's the experiments that didn't work out that sometimes are the most informative. So the societies that no longer exist sometimes can tell us more than those that have persisted.
That was Dr. Carol Ember and Dr. Peter Peregrin. This concludes the final episode of our four-part series on the origins of the Human Relations Area Files as an independent, cross-cultural research agency based at Yale, and as the publisher of the eHRAF World Cultures and Archaeology Databases. This series was brought to you by HRAF. Find all of the episodes of the Authority File on your favorite podcast app or on our website, choice360.org. Just click on the librarianship dropdown. On choice360.org, you'll also find information on Choice's entire product platform, including Choice Reviews, CC Advisor, Choice Webinars, resources for college libraries, our white papers, and a whole lot more. A great way to keep up with the Authority File is to join the Choice Authority File Facebook group, which you can access via the Choice Reviews Facebook page. As a member of the group, you can give us feedback, suggest podcast participants, chat with other listeners, and submit new topic ideas. That's all for this week. Thanks for joining us.